Welcome to Box Office Battle, where we take bombs, underappreciated classics, and forgotten hits, and maybe put them up on Mount Valhalla.
Ooh, that'd be an interesting possibility.
Maybe.
What would happen?
Maybe forget them.
What? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, these are high stakes.
It depends. But I'm the judge today, so I'll be deciding. I'm Biggs.
I'm Zach.
And I'm the beard.
Should we begin with a full disclosure about my failures as a podcaster and a man?
Sure.
Okay, so I failed as a podcaster and a man. This was originally supposed to be a Clint Eastwood themed episode, and I was going to watch Trouble with the Curve,
which I reviewed on one that didn't quite get recorded, where I also am a failure, because you would have heard this like last week.
Oh, well. And the fuckers at Netflix took it off, and the only Clint Eastwood movies they had left were Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, and Good, Bad, and the Ugly. And those are not really the targets for the films we talk about on Box Office Battle. So I just watched some stuff at random on Netflix and chose a movie. So these movies have nothing to do with each other at all.
All right. Tonight, I'm going to have the 1980 classic Any Which Way You Can, featuring Clint Eastwood.
Which he would have been doing Every Which Way But Loose, but once again, shit fell apart.
Yeah, I originally watched Every Which Way But Loose, and it's a great movie on its own. And so I thought, well, I'll go ahead and give the second movie a try. And it's the first movie. It's actually Any Which Way You Can is a sequel to the first one. Basically retreads the entire movie.
Okay.
Give or take. It has the same characters, and there's a few plot lines from the first movie, but it redoes the first movie in a way better format.
Ooh, so this is intriguing to me.
In the first movie, Every Which Way But Loose, you have Philo Beto, Clint Eastwood's character, is a bare-knuckle brawler in Southern California. His good friend Orville sets up fights for him, usually at construction sites that a bunch of people gather around. They put up the local hero. Clint Eastwood proceeds to beat the living shit out of them, which is a lot of fun. Yeah, Any Which Way You Can features Clyde the orangutan, his prominent role in this movie. He has a great little penchant that he has no respect for authority figures, as in cops. So whenever there's an empty cop car, he goes and leans in the window and takes a shit on the driver's seat.
He was also in Lancelot Link's Secret Chimp, but they had to take him off because he was too prone to shit on everything and then throw it at the cameraman.
So after the first fight, which opens up the movie, a couple of guys from New York, some shady mob types, show up and they want to put Philo Beto in a fight, a title fight, a bare knuckle underground title fight. These are the types of guys. They actually had a scene where they put a rattlesnake and a ferret in the same cage to the death.
Jesus,
I gotta
Christ.
Know who won.
The rattlesnake.
Woohoo! No underdog, huh?
I was actually rooting for the rattlesnake in this. Wow.
Did you have money on the fight? Is that what happened?
No, I just hate ferrets.
Yeah, it's a bad idea to wager on movies. I used to wager on Hooters over and over again, even though I've seen it and I know that Gene Hackman's team's gonna win. Did I say Hooters? Too much
wow.
wine tonight, man.
Wine spritzers are bad.
Hoosiers, that's what I meant to say.
Clint Eastwood's character, he's under a lot of money stress. His mom, who is basically the character Aunt Edna from the National Lampoon movies. Basically, this almost the same character, just an evil, wretched old lady.
You say movies like she survived more than the first one. Didn't she die in the first
one? Oh, she died in the first one and ended up on the car roof.
Yeah, they put her in a lawn chair with like
a note.
A note and an umbrella covering her corpse.
Yeah, because it's raining in Phoenix. Anyway, so he's under a lot of stress from his mom, so he takes... They offer him $10,000 as it's basically like a sign on for this fight. He takes the money. There's another $15,000 if he actually fights. Mob guys keep pestering him. They show up at his house. He really doesn't like how this is going. And so he's like, well, I'm not really going to fight. Mob shows up, roughs up Orville. Orville character. I really want to talk about the Orville character because they really played him up in this movie. He's drives a tow truck. And he listens to the CB scanner whenever somebody calls in a wreck or a stalled cars, a wreck cars. He puts whatever company it is. He has like all these magnetic signs. He just puts them on his tow truck and like beats him to the tow.
Nice.
So he's kind of an interesting character. Really gets you going on this. The one thing that's kind of missing from this movie is in the first movie, Every Which Way But Loose, Clint Eastwood is he's a bare knuckle brawler. But in the first movie, he is like the whitest fighter on the planet. It's almost like the character or the Notre Dame Fighting Irish way backwards.
Like my great, great, great uncle, John L. Sullivan.
Pretty much.
That's a true story, by the way. Just wanted to throw that on a podcast once.
In this one, he's actually got some boxing style to him. He's actually got some footwork to him in this movie. You know, they brought in from the first movie the Black Widows, the rival, they have a grudge against Philo Beto from the first movie.
They got a bone to pick?
They do have a bone to pick, because they didn't learn in the first movie that this revenge is going nowhere for you. You end up in a big pile of shit, pretty much. Get your bikes demolished, destroyed. You know, it didn't end up good. And they actually had some harbored some resentment from that, which doesn't pay out in this movie for them at all.
Are these boxers still Nazis?
The bikers are still Nazis. You know, they had a scene in the first part where they have like a Nazi flag behind him, and he's got the Nazi cap.
Plastica.
The SS cap. And so, you know, you really don't root for the Nazi biker guys. After the Philo Beto's family or mom gets roughed up and Orville gets roughed up, he decides that he wants to go to Jackson to partake in this fight. And there's some great scenes along the way. We got where he's messing with the bikers. The bikers show up as they're driving to Jackson. That's Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Near. The bikers show up alongside him. They obviously want to chase him down. He goes down this dirt road where there's some construction. Clint Eastwood takes a left turn. They didn't see it. And there's a oil truck working on the road. All the bikers go through, and this oil tar just like hardens on all the bikers. So they're like living statues. And so they take them by crane. They had to crane all the bikers to a hospital where they had to remove all the tar, which removed all the hair from their bodies. Which was really fun. They had a scene where because they had no hair, they had this big box of really awful, awful wigs. Like clown wigs. One had like a Rick James dreads. It was very entertaining. And they gave them like Sharpies to draw on eyebrows because they had no eyebrows. It just real fun watching them fuck with some Nazis. He shows up in Jackson. This title fight has gone viral at this point. There's people flying in from Texas, the East Coast.
Whoa. So is the internet part of this? Is this when Al Gore invented it?
No, this is word of mouth, brother. It's 1980.
Okay.
So
the viral part confused me.
You know, they actually had like regular telephones back in the day.
Okay. What are those?
You know, they're like, you know, little boxes. They got like a thing on them that you lift up and you can talk to them and you can talk to other people.
I'm not going to lie to you. This last conversation confused me so much that I just sort of blanked out.
Is this like in War Games?
Is this a sci-fi movie?
No.
Huh. Okay. Carry on.
All right. So this title fight, everybody's flying in. There's little old ladies placing bets on this.
Fuck yeah, there is.
There's two mob guys that are really pushing this fight because basically they're taking a take from each side on the bikers. Because their bikes were trashed in the tar, decide to sell all their bikes and put all their money on Philo Beto in this fight.
Wow. What a touching, poignant moment.
They get to Jackson. Throughout the movie, the other guy that he's supposed to fight, he actually befriends the other guy they're fighting. So, I mean, they're actually running, jogging.
Like Rocky and Apollo Creed?
Almost.
Oh, nice.
Do they embrace on the beach in a homoerotic fashion?
Not on a beach.
You almost got extra.
But they do points. Embrace?
But it was close. Oh. There were some...
Like how
really,
close?
They were actually going through this quarry, and the other guy slips and like starts falling down. Clint Eastwood grabs him cliffhanger style and pulls him up, and they have this touching moment.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how much sexual tension was there between the two of them?
About a 6.
All right, cool.
So would you classify this as a romantical comedy?
Not really.
Okay.
I know I'm going to lose some points there, but... All right, so they arrive in Jackson. Because they had gone back and forth, there had been some bar brawls along the way. They were actually, because Clint Eastwood saved the other guy at the quarry, and the other guy saved Clint Eastwood in a bar brawl. They were even at this point, but they couldn't leave it being even. So they decide to actually fight.
Rubber match.
This fight is epic.
It's as epic as a rattlesnake and a ferret?
This is Peter Griffin versus the chicken.
Oh,
epic.
You're losing, man.
No, this is for the listeners. No,
okay,
they
know that just subtracted you points.
We're basically, the format of the show is like American Idol in reverse. Like in this, the judge actually has some power. We can play to the listeners at home, but they're not changing the outcome.
Yeah, I ain't no Paula Abdul, motherfucker. I don't know who the judges are now. I just know she was a judge at some point, right?
Yes.
Okay. Never actually watched it.
So they start fighting in a barn. Some kids actually look in on the barn as they're walking by, see that they're fighting. The whole town is behind this fight. People have flown in to see this fight.
It's like high school football in Texas.
It's on.
Oh, here we go.
So the cops see the kids watching the movie or watching in the window. They call on the radio. It's on. The fight's on. The fight's on. People were leaving town because they thought the fight was off. I mean, there was a guy on the runway actually ready to take off. Here's a coming over the radio. The fight's back on. Drives the plane.
Oh, my
God. Through the town to see this fight.
That guy they actually put in the movie Flight. He was replayed by Denzel Washington.
So this is a battle for the ages.
This is an epic battle. They brawl through the entire town of Jackson Hole. They're going through windows. They're fighting in kitchens. It's great. I mean, just punching the living shit out of each other, like kidney punches. I mean, there was no holds barred. It's a bare knuckle underground.
Hulk Hogan was there?
No.
I feel like you keep teasing me, Brandon. Stop teasing me. I don't know why I keep trying to make it Rocky 3. I don't know why.
Thunderlips. I like the man's like moving on.
There's a point where they're fighting in the kitchen. Clint Eastwood actually gets hit down. He's getting back up, reaches and grabs the stove next to him. The other guy kicks his arm and breaks it in half. I mean, it's...
What, breaks his arm in half?
Yeah, it's like dangling at a really weird angle. They're like, oh, is the fight over? He gets up. It's not over.
Yeah, all he has now is a mace to use
as
a weapon.
He's got a left hand and a like limp. And so he's fighting one-handed. They go to the town square where I recognize there's a big archway made out of deer and elk antlers. It's kind of creepy in a way, but...
I wonder if they use that for the show Hannibal.
Finally, Philo Beto wins. There's a scene where they can obviously see that Philo is going to win, and the New Jersey Mafia guys actually had, because they were backing the other guy, they were actually going to shoot Philo. But the bikers, because they had money on Philo, beat up the New Jersey guys.
Nice. Good job, bikers.
Philo Beto wins. It's great. They're leaving town. The bikers show up. They actually stole one of the New Jersey limo New Jersey guy's limo. It was actually the two guys that were promoting the fight. Stole their limo, drove them out of town. Gives them a small cut of the fight money they won.
Ooh.
And credits.
That seems like a weird derivation, but did they actually learn a lesson?
Yeah,
Yeah, they learned not to fuck with Philo Beto.
Yeah. They've been fucked with for so long that you don't fuck with Philo Beto.
It's sort of Stockholm Syndrome, really.
A little bit, yeah.
It's a mutual respect at this, or just respect at this point. They're like, we've had our shit handed to us for far too long.
If you can't beat them, join them.
Okay. That does sound like a Rocky Apollo thing. Back to Rocky 3. All right, Zach, Can before you announce your movie and talk about it, are there elements of Rocky III in it?
There are literally no elements present. But I'm not going to tease you about it. I'm not going to tease you about it.
All right.
I'm being upfront with you.
I hope you can at least work in Rocky IV.
I'll do my best. So, Brandon gave us a little slice of Americana. I'm going to give us a little slice of the crime world of Britain with Christopher Nolan's debut feature made on a $6,000 budget following.
Did it lose its money?
Nah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it would have been
I'd hate to see Christopher Nolan's career snuffed out in a flash.
Before it started?
Yeah.
So, following, we follow a lead character who he's a young man, and we open on him talking to a police officer about his compulsion to follow people. And it's ostensibly, he says, to gather inspiration for his first novel, to give these little details to characters to make them feel more real. And he says that when he started, he had hard and fast rules for who he would follow and how long he would follow them. And he would just go, he was very interested in just seeing what people did when they thought no one was looking and how they lived their lives. He found it fascinating. Till one day he meets a man, a handsome man in a dark suit, and he follows him for a little too long, and he follows him to this little diner. And the handsome man comes over to him and he's picked up that he's being followed. And so he asks the young man who he is, and the young man gives the name Bill. And so Bill asks who the young man is, and the man says, "My name's in my bag that you've been staring at all day." So Bill, who's been shy and scared that he's going to get the shit kicked out of him this whole time, says, "Fine, what's your name and what's in your bag?" And the man introduces himself as Cobb, a name familiar to Christopher Nolan fans. And he pops open his briefcase, and it's filled with CDs. And Cobb tells Bill that he's a burglar, and that's not his main source of income, but his favorite source of income. And so he takes, after a little discussion, he takes Bill out to do some robbing with him. And they go about, and Cobb is teaching Bill his methods and what he does and why he does the things he does. And they go through and they take the stuff of value from these houses. And he explains that what he really enjoys about burglary isn't the money he makes off of it or the items he steals. What gets him into it, the reason he does it, is that he loves to show people what they had and what they didn't appreciate. And he says when someone goes in and they see their house has been robbed, it forces them to reevaluate their life, and it forces them to look at the things they had and why they had them and what's really important. So he doesn't just steal, but he'll just misplace things or move things around or stir up shit in their life. Like at one house, he takes some women, some ladies' undergarments he has and puts them in the bed to stir up a little marital strife. And
so Cobb is a douchebag.
Cobb is a douche. Okay. And Bill starts buying into it because Cobb is so charming in his douchery. And Bill is such a malleable guy. He gets swept up into it. He starts to get really into the burglary. And Cobb gives him some advice. He tells him to cut his hair and change his look. And so he does. He cuts his hair. He shaves his beard. And he starts dressing in a suit. And he meets this blonde woman that he's attracted to. And he starts talking to the blonde woman. And he realizes as he goes back to her house that they had burgled her house earlier in the day. So he sits talking to this woman. He wants to get to know her. And he starts to learn a little bit. But the woman's closed off. What we do learn is that she used to date a man who we know only as the bald guy, who's essentially a low level thug. And that the reason she left him is the bald guy murdered someone in her apartment. And so Bill goes back and he talks to Cobb a little bit, and they do some more burglaring and talking, and Cobb gives him a credit card and tells him to sign it. Says, "Your name is now D. Lloyd." So Bill chooses the name Daniel Lloyd for himself, and he starts getting really into the burglary. Eventually we learn that Cobb and the blonde woman have known each other all along. And that Bill has been trapped and is now their pawn because he was so willing to join this world that it's going to be easy to set him up to take a fall for Cobb. Because when Cobb, he had burgled a home earlier and found a dead old woman beaten to death. And he didn't want it to get traced back to him, so he needed someone to take the fall by establishing that there are other burglars with his M.O. around the city. And Cobb is understandably not delighted about this. And so he goes and he turns himself into the police, setting up the scene we had seen earlier. And he's explaining his story, trying to get himself. He knows he's done things he can't take back at this point. But he's hoping to try to clear his name to some degree and get a little amnesty. Except for what we don't realize is that Cobb had set him up even further. Cobb, it turns out, was working for the bald guy all along. And part of his job was to kill the blonde woman to get the bald guy's vengeance and to make sure this woman who knew what he did was gone. So he murders her. Cobb murders the blonde woman with a hammer that we had seen Bill/Daniel Lloyd/the young man use earlier in the film in a burglary. And so the police find this hammer with her blood on it and his fingerprints all over and take him in. And he's trying to explain that Cobb is the one who did it. And they find the stuff from his house that he had burgled from the blonde woman's home that essentially frames him. And they don't even believe Cobb exists. They go to an address that Bill gives them and Cobb's not there. Nobody's there. It's under the name Daniel Lloyd. And Cobb is able to disappear and we hit the credits.
I kind of glazed over one of the main parts of this movie, which is Clyde the orangutan.
I was going to say, your orangutan count was real low, and I was going to be very disappointed.
There is so much great comedic humor come out of this orangutan. He is trained a few different things. First is the term right turn Clyde, because usually on the right side of the truck, anytime he does a right turn Clyde, he punches out the window. So it's great whenever there's a cop on the right side of the truck or a biker, anything like that, that you get the orangutan just punching and knocking out somebody, which is great. I did talk about the shitting in cop cars, which is a great, great comedic, great, great comedy right there. The other is, strip down the whatever make of car, which basically involves him ripping the car apart, taking the bumper, just throwing it, taking the hood off, fenders, which worked out great in a few times where you'd say, strip down the Mercury or strip down the Cadillac that the bad guys, New Jersey guys, show up in. As he's standing on the porch, Clyde shows up and rips apart his car while he's watching, which is great.
There are two things that really interest me about Following and that really drew me to this movie and that made me excited to talk about it. The first is that in its own right, it's a very tightly scripted, very watchable, really interesting neo-noir crime thriller in its own right. It works really well as a story on its own. The other thing, and the thing I want to focus on here, is it's interesting to look at in the evolution of a filmmaker. Now, this is Chris Nolan's first movie, and it does have an incredibly minuscule budget, but it's used to great effect. You know, he shoots in black and white to cover up some lighting stuff, used a lot of natural light, using unknown actors, really rehearsing scenes so that they could do them quickly in one or two takes. And you can see a lot of the germs of what Christopher Nolan would become known for in his work. The plot is presented in a nonlinear way, heavy use of shadows, a lot of film school stuff that's really appealing about this movie. You also see a lot of the hallmarks of like the interesting dialogue that has a lot of layers to it. The scenes being presented out of order. You can see his love of the noir genre and trying to merge it into other story types. One thing I really appreciate on the movie is one of the things I like about noir and neo-noir genres, and one thing Christopher Nolan is really great at, and it's especially evident in this movie, is setting up the characters in such a way that every time you learn something new about them, it forces you to rethink what you thought about this character. And they're constantly shifting and growing over the course of the movie. And this movie is only 70 minutes. It's a quick watch. And each character has, even if they don't have an arc, so to speak, you learn more about them and they become very real characters. It's an impressive debut, to say the least, and you can tell it was a labor of love.
So you're saying that Christopher Nolan's first movie and germs of stuff that's coming, what you're really saying to me is not ready for prime time. Any Which Way You Can is the movie. This is Clint Eastwood's penultimate movie right here. People may have said, or Unforgiven was better, or $6 Million Baby was better. But no, it all started with this movie.
You know,
I'm pretty sure that was Million Dollar Baby, not $6 million.
Whatever.
They didn't rebuild or anything.
They should have. It would have been a better movie.
Not this.
That would have been a great.
I think you stumbled upon a fucking epic B movie that should be explored later. But I'm just saying, I think it's Million Dollar Baby. That's all.
You know, you're right that I did emphasize the germs of seeing a growth in a filmmaker, and I do think that's important in this movie, but I want to talk about some of the stuff it does well in its own right. The dialogue and the character scenes is so well written in that it gives exposition in a way that doesn't feel clunky or forced, and you get a lot, you learn about these characters. It's very tightly wound. It's very well plotted. The characters are so easy to buy into as these real people because you don't know these actors, and they acquit themselves very well with the material. They sell you on sort of the reality of this, even though it's clear that we're being told a story. It's a very well told story with a lot of interesting little twists that you don't see coming. There's no big M. Night Shyamalan style twist, but it's rather little twists along the way that keep things fresh and exciting, so that even though there are things you know to expect from the type of movie it is and the genre it's in, there's little surprises in there that make it a really cool treat.
One thing I want to say about Any Which Way You Can is the costuming for some of this is epic. It was really pandering to the redneck, down-to-earth people in the late 70s, early 80s. So there's basically it's a country music background. And that was the era when 1980s or late 70s, early 80s, when the country music had some great costumes where they had collars that went down to their armpits. And, you know, the Johnny Cash where he played the guitar, like, almost walking away from it. Great.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was
done. Okay.
So, I just like to point out that you used this movie plays and panders to rednecks like that's a good quality. I just want to make sure that that's on the record. See, this
That's a pretty good point.
This movie plays to people with a little bit of sophistication. Now, it's not profound. It's not going to change the way you look at the world. But it's done in a way that you have to be paying attention. And in very Chris Nolan fashion, it's got this almost triple... You may be familiar with the conceit of the framing story within literature. This is almost multiple framing stories stacked in on each other like a rusting nesting doll. And it's a very intricate way to plot a movie, which Chris Nolan has become very well known for. But the intricacies of this plot are presented in a way that are so easy to pick up on and follow, even without some of the editing tricks he had to use in Memento, like switching from black and white to color. The entire film is black and white, and it focuses on a very small group of people. But the way it's presented becomes very easy to follow very quickly, and it allows for little revelations in the plot that can change the way you view it.
You two have both given me pretty good cases for your movies. I gotta admit, you've definitely hit me on a lot of fronts. I like Christopher Nolan. I like noir. Definitely like anything where there's a con being run.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that I like a lot. However, I do like Clint Eastwood beating the shit out of people, and I do like orangutan shitting on cop cars. This is a hard decision, and it's a weird one because you're really hitting like both sides of my psyche here. Now, it should be said that I'm the judge today. It's not often I get to sit and listen to movies because a lot of time I cover them a little bit more, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of happens. And I've decided that I'm going to go mad with power. Power that's never, ever been explored before.
Is this going to change the way we look at box office battle?
It could. So here's what I'm going to do. I want you each to describe why your movie is like a certain Rocky movie. And I'm going to judge it off of that because it's I can't decide off of your cases. They're both so good.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So Zach, why don't you go first?
I'm going to lead off? Okay. Well, I'm actually willing to make two comparisons. The first is...
I need one.
Just one?
One. I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay.
Wow, you are I'm drunk with power.
I'm mad with power right now, dude.
Then I'm going to go...
And I'm drunk. So yeah, you could say I'm drunk with power.
I'm going to go with then the option that's less of a stretch. And I'll say that this film has some elements in common with Rocky 1 in that we're following an underdog protagonist who's down on his luck, is clearly not succeeding the way he's meant to be, but he introduces us to a world that we don't understand that much of and makes it riveting and an exciting world that we wish we could spend more time in.
Okay, Brandon. Now, if it is Rocky 1 you're comparing to, it is okay. But you need the reasoning down. I'm just saying, you've got six of them. But I will not penalize you for picking the same one if it compares to the first one. Just throwing that caveat out there to be fair.
All right. So I'm just going to push past the boxing thing because obviously we got the boxing thing and the white man boxing.
Clearly, we could compare it in that sense to any.
And
I appreciate you not taking the easy road.
The easy route.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking.
That's a good road to take, the high one. It's definitely a good one right now.
That's integrity in a man.
So the what I'm going to have to say is, you know, the friendship that's portrayed in this movie between the two boxers, where they really have respect for each other and, you know, want to actually put what they feel into the what they're fighting for. You know, Clint Eastwood, he's fighting for his girl, much like Rocky's fighting for Adrian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the on the other side, I'm going to go with, like, Dolph or Rocky 3, where, you know, the guy's coming from a place where he's pushed by some really awful people. Where, you know, Rocky 3, you have the Russians that are really pushing for it in the same way. And, you know, comes out on top of it, even pushes through that.
Okay. This decision did not come easily. As I said, your arguments were a draw. Now, I gotta say, Rocky is my favorite of the Rocky movies, the first one.
But
Rocky 3 is pretty fun, too. However, you described Rocky 4 to me. Zach is the winner.
I truly am the greatest to ever play this game.
Ironically, what's the name of that movie?
Following.
Following, not forgotten. And I'm, yeah, okay.
It is decided.
That's Mad with Power, baby. I gotta be honest, I'm totally gonna watch both of these movies.
Fuck yeah.
They both sound spectacular. And I'm not even just saying that because I downed half a bottle of wine. I'm literally gonna watch both of these movies. So I gotta go incomplete on both of them because I haven't seen them. So,
what I would have to say, the one thing that I didn't bring up because it's kind of a damning argument, is there's some a couple things that happen in Any Which Way You Can that were really
racist?
Interesting. No.
Oh, okay. I thought this is one of those uncomfortable feelings older movie. It's like, hey, this movie is really racist.
No, this has elements of date rape in it.
Ooh.
Oh, that's, yeah.
He taught the monkey how to inject tranquilizers into a banana and give it to a girl monkey.
Well, that's no good. Hold on.
I thought Revenge of the Nerds was bad.
I thought this was family friendly. Holy shit.
Oh, I didn't think that for a second.
And the first one, there's a montage where they're walking around town with Philo Beto and his monkey, and they walk by an adult theater and walk inside. And after the next scene, they're actually headed to a zoo to get the monkey laid.
See, that almost makes up for the date rape. Almost, ladies.
Well, it was kind of a weird sequence. And at the very end of the film, like, Orville is sitting in the truck and was thinking about some girl, and I think she might have been popular at the time, and she's like, oh, she's way out of my league. And he opens the glove box, and there's a banana with a syringe, like,
oh my god,
taped to it. And I was like, whoa,
fucked up shit.
Any Christopher Nolan date rape in this movie?
No,
nope, just murdering the girl.
Yeah, it's just murdering
clean.
The girl, you
it's
know,
it's all clean.
Family fun.
So what would you give this movie a grade for?
I would say satisfactory on Any Which Way You Can, and I don't have to say incomplete on the other Chris Nolan movie, but it's definitely something I would be interested in watching.
Yeah, I didn't even know that movie existed until he just told me tonight.
It's definitely worth checking out. It's not a perfect movie by any means. It's not even a great movie, but it's a very good, very watchable movie. It helps that they kept things tight for budget sakes. That actually goes a long way to helping the story. It helps that it's short and lean, and it is only 70 minutes. It's a quick watch. So having that lean nature to it really goes a long way. Some of the flaws I didn't want to mention, so I didn't damn myself, is there is a lot of handheld camera work for budgetary reasons. And while for the most part it looks really good, there are some scenes that are a little too shaky to follow. And the acting is fine, but it's one of those things I talked a lot about.
Guys repeated in his movies.
Yeah. Well, he's given them some small background roles and stuff, but I mean, they are not actors now.
Give him back. Background role is in, like, you can see one of them running out of the hospital in terror and Dark Knight.
One of them is like one of the Wayne board members, and like one guy's, yeah. But
so even that movie, okay.
Yeah, they're fine. But one of the things I talked about being able to sort of see the germs of what would become Chris Nolan's best stuff. One of the things you can see is how his material is elevated to another level with just slightly higher caliber of actor. It really does add extra dimensions to the characters. But as written, it's still really good. The guy who plays Cobb doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, but I thought he was the best out of all of them. He plays his sort of sleazy but charming burglar really well. The score is not great. Luckily, it's pretty easy to get past. For the most part, though, it's a really strong movie. I'd give it a strong satisfactory. Like, it does its job. It tells its story well. It's got a few unique touches, and it's interesting as sort of the development of a filmmaker. It's a cool movie. I'd recommend people check it out. It's very different from a lot of the independent movies you watch. It has a very style and that it commits to. It doesn't feel like it's trying to be a million things like a lot of first-time filmmakers do.
And I'd also like to recommend that you like the Not Safe for Network page on Facebook.
Please do.
Where you can hear all kinds of shit about these movies and other things.
The other thing I had on that was the one cameo that it's not even listed on IMDb is the bartender in one of the scenes is played the manager in Major League.
Oh,
nice.
We saw him in a Kevin Costner flick on Real Roulette. That's the right. Other day, and I only referred to him as the manager from Major League because I don't know what the fuck his name is, but you just hear him and you know and who you know he is.
Yeah.
He even had the mustache.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to give a incomplete to Mr. Eastwood and his funny date raping orangutan. He's not funny because of the date raping. He is funny and also a date rapist.
He's also forgotten.
Fill those seats so we don't have to.